decision to stay off Twitter because I was really scared that it was all just going to start up again.
A woman has been jailed for at least 14 years for murdering her 11-month-old son. Emma Wilson from Berkshire claimed the baby's older brother had caused his unsurvivable head injury and fractured arms, legs and ribs. The Labour leader has accused David Cameron of denying a cost-of-living crisis. It's after the government said virtually all British workers' take-home pay went up faster than prices last year. NHS bosses have admitted cancer services in England for people aged over 65 need improving. It follows a charity's warning that pensioners with the disease aren't getting the treatment they're entitled to because they're considered too old. Les Scaife, who's in his 80s, says he had to insist he was treated after he was diagnosed. He says age should never be a factor.
To me, it doesn't come into it. You treat the symptoms. But I did feel that there was something in the background there that I felt, rightly or wrongly, that I wasn't going to get the same treatment as someone younger than me would.
The energy watchdog Ofgem says it's reviewing the code of practice for price comparison websites. Yesterday, the boss of Co-op Energy accused the sites of pushing up energy bills because of the commission they charge. And a shipment of Marmite and Iron Brew bound for a British food shop in Canada has been seized by customs. It's part of a crackdown on additives that are banned in the country. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
BCFM.
Yes, it's Friday again, it's 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Tim Kent. He's the Lib Dem leader on Bristol City Council and councillor for Whitchurch Park. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, has the Bristol baby's heart scandal reared its ugly head again this week as Avon Coroner comes to a narrative verdict which is extremely critical of United Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust? Daphne Havercroft from South West Whistleblowers Health Action Group was at the inquest. And flooding in the Somerset Levels. At least there's plenty of water about to keep the nuclear power stations cool, but has enough been done to drain the levels? And we hear from former US Marine Ken O'Keefe on the programme he was making in London about the 9/11 attacks. That's the show our guest from Sweden last week, former IBM employee and journalist Chris Bolin, was due to appear on when he was detained at Heathrow Airport and deported back to Sweden. Plus, Montreux, Geneva and also Ukraine and Kiev may well come up, I think, when we do a tour of the world's hotspots with Martin Summers. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius with some showers. Already started just out there as I was coming into the studio. And this weekend, highs of 10, drier on Saturday, some heavy showers on Sunday and windy both days. So if you're going out and about, try and do it on Saturday rather than Sunday. Next week, highs of 7 Celsius, sunshine and showers and windy at times. Next weekend, that's the 1st and 2nd of February, highs of 1 Celsius. That's not very high. Sunny, but much, much colder. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Lib Dem councillor for Whitchurch Park, and he's also the leader of the Liberal Democrats on Bristol City Council, Tim Kent. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon.
Now, first of all, got to ask you about the Lord Renard scandal. This has been bubbling on for over a year now. And what are your thoughts immediately about the way that your party has dealt with the allegations against Lord Renard?
I think it's always been a difficult issue to deal with because of the nature of the allegations. I think, you know, within the media, sometimes they've tried to over-egg what he's been accused of. Having said that, it's still very serious. I think when you make any form of advance, an inappropriate advance, and you're in a position of power, you need to think about that. And I think the investigation has shown that the accusations made against him were credible. Maybe they didn't reach a certain level which perhaps was required by the party. But I think a perfectly reasonable request has been made of him, that one, he should apologise, but secondly, he should mean that, which is about reflecting on your behaviour and changing your behaviour. Chris has refused to do that. He doesn't seem to accept that he's done anything wrong, and I think that's of concern. And I think the leader's right. I don't think Chris can retake the whip until he's willing to accept that his actions in the past were unacceptable. Those people deserve an apology, but also he needs to reflect and change his behaviour.
But he hasn't actually broken the law, so why should he admit to doing something wrong?
It's not an issue of breaking the law. It's an issue of what is appropriate behaviour within, one, a workplace, but two, a member organisation. I mean, a lot of these accusations were made while he was the chief executive of the party, so they go back several years. And the accusations are of, you know, inappropriate advances. It's not just a simple matter of, can I buy you a drink? It was about invading people's personal space. It was about touching them. It wasn't about sexual assault, as was claimed in some newspapers. So just to clear, but still, those are serious accusations when you're in a position of power. The findings were that they were credible accusations, and I think it's perfectly reasonable to for Nick Clegg to say to Chris that he doesn't just need to apologise, because the apology is about accepting you've done something wrong and that you do need to change your behaviour. Now, Chris has refused to do that. I think that puts it in a very difficult position on how I can see Chris being an active member of the party if he's not willing to be able to accept what he did was wrong.
But it's not just Lord Renard that's been unwilling to say sorry. It's also the Liberal Democrat Party that's been unwilling to address this for the last 18 months. Do you think would you agree that the party's failed to a certain extent here? And also, do you think that the response now has been adequate?
I think they have tried to address this. It is difficult when you're a democratic member organisation. Our leader doesn't just have the power to say you are out. That's not the way it works within the Liberal Democrats. And it's perfectly reasonable that a process had to go through. I think what's becoming clear is that there were rumours and there were allegations around the time when Chris Renard was chief executive. It doesn't appear that those were dealt with then. Of course, it is always, I do understand that it's difficult to deal with a rumour. And people will understand in politics, there can be a lot of gossip. A lot of the time, that's not always true. And it does put leaders in very difficult positions when these things come out. I think what is clear now is we do have a report into this. The report, although it's saying a certain test level has not been reached, it is saying those allegations were credible. I think based on that, Nick is right to insist that Chris has to apologise, and that apology has to be meant.
Okay, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, can I ask you to comment on this too? Because the allegations fall between normal behaviour and criminal behaviour. What are your thoughts about the way the Liberal Democrat Party has dealt with this? And also, I suppose the other side of it all is, you know, if someone does have somebody touch them inappropriately, invade their personal space, reports it to up to a higher level and nothing happens, that doesn't really mean, it doesn't show confidence in the organisation. And it actually is a form of bullying, isn't it?
Well, yes, and I think we're all aware of what the background to this is. I don't think they've handled it particularly badly. I think I agree with what Tim said there. They've got a difficult position. If somebody hasn't broken the law, then there isn't a legal, you know, that there's a legal issue, that there's no legal issue to deal with. But there's a political issue. It's about perceptions, isn't it? If people perceive that you're not taking this seriously, that's going to damage the Liberal Democrat Party electorally and so on. So, you know, just in any organisation, you can't have people who are numpties losing the ball for you. And that's got to, you know, there has to be some mechanism with any political organisation or any social organisation to deal with reputational issues, which are not necessarily legal. You know, we all take this stuff seriously, and you know, that's why it's got to be approached in a very careful way, because you shouldn't be accusing people of things without listening to their defence as well. You know, there's two sides to everything.
Now, Tim, last weekend in the Daily Mail, Sarah Vine said simply, why didn't the Lib Dem ladies give the old goat a slap? Basically, why wasn't this dealt with earlier? Because it's been dragging on for months and months.
I think when you're in that situation and someone makes advances to you like that, it's very difficult to judge unless you've been there. They can be very quick. Sometimes you yourself can be in shock. You're not too sure what has happened and you don't quite know how to react. I can perfectly understand why they felt at the time they didn't have somewhere to turn. And I can perfectly understand why these revelations have come out now. And partly, I think that was because Chris Renard was becoming active again within the party. And I suspect their main motivations, they wanted to try to make sure other women felt safe. And I think that is a good motivation. And they've taken a lot of stick for coming out, and they really shouldn't have had to go through that.
This is the obvious sort of conclusion to this. Is the Liberal Democrat Party a safe place for women to be members?
Well, I think any party, any member organisation, any workplace has to face these issues on occasion. I think what is clear is that we are attempting to tackle it. I think what also the party is looking to do is make sure it's got clear procedures and protections in place for the future to make sure this doesn't happen. I think there are problems with political parties, and that is they do attract a great deal of loyalty amongst their members and their supporters. And sometimes that loyalty can conflict with other rational decisions, such as you said, why wasn't it dealt with at the time? And part of that could be the women's own loyalty to the party and not wanting to create the media storm that's been created. But we can't cover these things up. They do need to be dealt with, and we do need to make sure we've got robust procedures to deal with them. And ultimately, there is an issue about bringing a party into disrepute. This whole thing has brought the party into disrepute. I think Chris Renard has to accept it's his actions, his unwelcomed actions and unacceptable actions that have done that, which a lawyer investigating has said that the accusations against him are credible. And now he has a choice. He can apologise and also assure people he will change his behaviour in future, or I think he will have to accept he will need to leave the party.
You've also had a little bit of trouble with the MP for Portsmouth South, haven't you, Mike Hancock, along similar lines, and there's been an altercation, just looking online, just over the last day or so, outside his house, with a fight between a photographer and Hancock's son. The allegations are that also Mike Hancock made unwelcome sexual advances toward a vulnerable constituent, and he, it seems, has also been suspended from the party. He's been suspended this week too. This seems to be a bit of a running sore in the Liberal Democrats.
I think it goes through all parties. I think we've seen over different years different scandals. At the moment, there are two or three that are coming out within our party. I think the key thing is we cannot hide away from this. We do need to deal with this. There are issues. I believe there are particular issues, I've got to say, in Parliament amongst male MPs and peers, a minority who I think believe somehow they have some power of attraction over women, which they simply just do not have in the real world.
It's the power. That's what they think, is that the people will be attracted to. Never mind if they look a little bit rough, like I'm afraid the Portsmouth South MP Mike Hancock.
You're being generous to say he looks rough, to be honest. I mean, it's when you see the pictures of him, you do really wonder what planet he's on. I think this is a real problem. They think that they are in powerful positions. They think this will be attractive in the main to women, but it's not just women, it is men also that this is an issue for. And I think within politics, it's not just within the Liberal Democrats, it's within all political parties, and there have been recent accusations in other political parties as well regarding sexually inappropriate behaviour. We've got to make sure we're stamping down on this and saying, you must run your lives just as everyone else does within their own workplaces and their own homes and their own families. Their behaviour will be unacceptable anywhere else. Now, it is also unacceptable within politics.
You've said this is something you find unacceptable, and obviously that has to work its way through your party in a democratic fashion, even though some decisions aren't democratic, particularly when they're going into national policy. But that aside, have you ever experienced this kind of thing at all within politics?
Yeah, I have. I myself experienced it as a young activist. It was a brief moment, but someone touched me inappropriately, and I've got to say, it's one reason why I am so sympathetic to the case of the women bought, because I didn't react to it immediately. I was pretty shocked.
What did you do at the time?
Well, this is what actually still leaves me angry 15, 18 years later, is that I did nothing at the time. I froze. I was in disbelief. And I didn't confront the person who did it, because it happened in a crowd, although I knew who it was. And it is literally, as those seconds tick by, which seem far more, it becomes harder and harder to confront. And it still is a real issue with me. Not that I'm embarrassed about it, I'm just angry about it. And I'm particularly angry about it because I believe that probably that individual thought that was acceptable to try that on them with someone else. And it particularly gets me angry. So I know that person wasn't an MP, wasn't a lord, it was nobody special in that sense of thing. It was another party activist. It's just unacceptable in life. And so I perfectly understand why the women at the time felt they were not actually. I think one or two of them did confront him. I think one did actually get an apology from him at the time. But I can understand why others did not feel able to do that.
The bottom line is, you want to know that the party is going to take such an accusation seriously and do something about it, whether it's not necessarily removing the person from the party, but to let them, give them a very clear signal on an official level that this is not acceptable. This didn't happen with Renard, and it didn't happen with you, Tim.
I mean, well, I've never complained about what happened to me. It was one incident, and I've never raised a complaint, because if I was going to raise it, it would be with the individual who did it. I don't think that I would need to go to the party on that. With Chris, it's a different thing, because also he was the chief executive at the time. I agree, a clear line has to be drawn on this, and I think that's what Nick Clegg is doing, and he's saying an apology, and I think by that he means a real apology, not apologies forced out of you. And now I can't see how Chris can provide that, because he's simply not accepting the report that's been written, which says these accusations are credible. Based on that, I actually cannot see how Chris can have a future within the Lib Dems, and that's greatly regrettable, because he did a lot to build our party. It was Chris that helped mould our party and increase its size, and we owe him a lot. At the same time, we owe the rest of our party members, activists and wider society, that we will not tolerate such behaviour.
Okay, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This week, I'd just like to put to you some news from France. The Financial Times have been saying that, asking the question, in fact, has Hollande's social experiment failed? Socialist experiment failed. Basically, what's happened over there is, as you keep saying, the rich have been taxed. But what's happened is many of the rich have actually officially, even though they still spend some time in France, left the country. They've moved their money out of the country, a lot of them. And it looks like the attempt in France to do the sorts of socialist policies taxing the rich that you've been suggesting here are actually now shown to be roundly a failure. Britain, the growth levels according to the IMF are picking up, starting to get higher. France, they're not.
All right, well, there's quite a lot in that. First of all, the French economy is bigger today than it was before the crash, unlike the British economy. So let's just get a bit of perspective on all of this. I think François Hollande is in a difficult position, because he doesn't really control his own policy, because he's inside the euro. So ultimately, really, he needs cooperation from the German government if he's going to do anything constructive. And of course, it's very easy for people to leave the French jurisdiction if he raised taxes just in France. And of course, in other words, he's got to develop a Euroland policy. And to do that, he needs partners in Berlin, and he hasn't really got them. In actual fact, the left won the election in Germany, but the former Communist Party, the left party, were not. But for cultural reasons, they're forbidden to be part of coalitions, and the centre, if you like, won't make coalitions with them. But if they were prepared to do coalitions, then the left would have won, and then we'd be looking at a left-wing government in France and a left-wing government in Germany, and then you could see perhaps a change in European policy. But at the moment, you've got a right-wing government in Germany, not a very strong one, because they haven't got a majority in the Bundestag, and they're not really partners for Hollande. I mean, in any case, Hollande is very, very... What he said to do, he was not going to do anything dramatic.
Yes, he is. He's saying he's going to be doing public pulling down public spending and cutting tax. That's the heart of his new plan.
So in other words, he's changed course because he couldn't do what he wanted to do in the first place. And there are
no,
all
it's
sort-
because what he tried to do didn't work.
No, it didn't work because the fact of the matter is that you can't just change the government and change the economic situation.
So are they really two separate countries, Germany and France, if they're both in the euro?
In the past, France and Germany could pursue opposite, contradictory policies, but they would still cause tension even when they had their own currencies. When they're in the same currency, ultimately, and they're the two big players that determine euro policy, and at the moment, because of France's economic weakness, the Germans are in a strong position. And Hollande really, I mean, for example, the European Central Bank is not engaged in any quantitative easing. So if you're saying, well, why is Britain's economy showing signs of growth? It's because we're doing quantitative easing wall to wall, just like the Americans. The Germans are very opposed to quantitative easing. That really ties Hollande's hands because he doesn't control his own economic policy.
We've also seen this week big trumpeted announcements by the IMF. Britain's doing really well. We're now up to 2.4% growth.
That's what
the so-called impartial IMF are now looking at the British economy and saying that's where we're now heading. We're now heading in the right direction. A lot of this is to do with the fact that unemployment has taken its biggest, has gone down to the highest amount, the second highest amount ever, and it's now down to 7.1% unemployment. This is a fantastic performance by Osborne, looking at growth going up. Martin, you've really been shown to be wrong, haven't you?
I don't accept that for obvious reasons. Who accepts being wrong? I think the figures
speak for themselves, don't they? Unemployment down, growth up.
Yes, but we're talking about a very recent phenomenon. The British economy is still smaller than it was before the crash, unlike the French economy, unlike the US economy. Larry Summers picked up, who's a former Treasury Secretary in the US, was criticising Osborne for his policies at Davos this morning. I was reading about it. He was saying, well, you could have actually had growth 2 or 3 years ago if you'd chosen to have it. I think what's actually happened is a political decision to go for growth. Look at Help to Buy, for example, which is stoking the property bubble. This is electioneering. It's not really economic policy. And don't forget, both in the US, Britain and everywhere else, it's all underpinned by quantitative easing. And if you think that a Labour government would be able to resolve these problems, I would disagree, because in actual fact they're fundamental problems with a global system which is completely out of control. And in a sense, the Labour front bench are being very timid in their critique of it. They're just saying, well, we'll tinker at the margins, which is pretty much what Hollande was saying. But ultimately, tinkering at the margins in a situation like this is just tinkering at the margins.
Tim, what are your thoughts on these figures? Unemployment down to 7.1%. Mark Carney's the new King Carney, I like to call him, the new king of the Bank of England, to replace Mervyn, is saying he wanted unemployment down to 7%. He's nearly there already. And also we've got the IMF saying you're going to get growth in the UK this year of 2.4%.
Well, I think everyone would agree that the reduction in unemployment is good news, and it is now looking like it's becoming a sustained reduction. This is now not just one quarter's figures, but we've now seen it throughout the year, a reduction in unemployment. One thing we do need to reflect is that some of these jobs are part-time jobs that are being created, not always full-time jobs. So I'm not going to go out there and cry that this is amazing news. But what we are seeing is the economy now moving in the right direction. Now, when there was a lot of doubt about the coalition's plans, I think in the main they are actually showing that they are doing the job, and actually what they've got is a bit more long-term depth in them rather than quick spikes.
But
it's taken us a while to get there, but we are now actually seeing that growth, and it is now looking like it will be sustainable.
I don't want to burst your bubble, Tim, but the University of Sheffield, the Centre for Regional Economic and Social Research, says the actual level of unemployment in Britain is around about 3.5 million, a million more than the government admits to. That's the highest official estimate, is, and 2 million more than the number claiming Job Seekers Allowance. Their report, published just at the end of last year at Sheffield Hallam University, documents the scale of hidden unemployment amongst men and women who fail to qualify for Job Seekers Allowance or are diverted onto other benefits. A report presents an alternative set of unemployment figures for every local authority in Britain, exposing the extent to which hidden unemployment is concentrated in the weakest local economies. Now, not surprising that they're based in Sheffield, because most of the weaker economies are up north, the old industrial areas. But how much can we rely on this figure of 7.1%?
Well, governments have always played games around figures, and perhaps the better figure to look at is what's the total amount employed in the country. Now, for the first time ever, that's breached 30 million. And so what we can see is the total amount of jobs. That gets us away from whose unemployment figure is right, is the total amount of employment. So what we have seen is a definite spike, a definite increase in jobs, I think by around about a million over the last couple of years.
How many of those jobs are proper full-time jobs that pay a living wage? It seems loads more. I mean, even full-time work now, sometimes it's not paying enough people enough money to pay the bills.
No, I think that's a reasonable point. And I do think too many of those new jobs have been part-time jobs, lower paid jobs. And this is why I'm not going out there crowing about this plan is amazing. What I'm saying is we're now beginning to see the signs of recovery. It's a sustained recovery. We've got to work far more at it. And I think over the next couple of years, and there's still the issue that, you know, that people's take-home pay has not recovered over the last 4 years. I think it is accepted that on average, the average take-home pay for the average family is down about £25 a week. We've got to now make sure that everyone begins to feel the effects of the recovery, because I expect most of your listeners at home are thinking, well, I'm no better off. And it's those people who've really seen an increase in their incomes over the last year, of those who've managed to get work, get the jobs, and have come back into the economy and paying taxes. It's great news for them, but now we must make sure this is felt throughout the economy. And part of that is, of course, about reducing tax, and it's about trying to make sure those people on minimum wages aren't actually paying income tax, which is ludicrous, because everybody knows the minimum wage is not enough to live on. And secondly, I would argue, as well as increasing the tax threshold, what we need to do is increase the level of minimum wage, because it has got into a slightly ridiculous situation that government is subsidising wages through welfare and actually subsidising businesses in paying minimum wage. And actually, what would be better off for the economy and better off for people generally is to increase the minimum wage far closer to that of the of an affordable living standard. And I think we should be pushing for, you know, a minimum wage closer to £7 an hour.
Martin, more than half of people claiming housing benefit are actually in work. These kind of benefits were compared, interestingly, this week on BBC Radio 4, The Long View. Jonathan Friedland was saying back in the early 1600s they had the poor laws where it was necessary to subsidise wages so that people could afford to buy bread. We've got the situation now, he was saying, where actually it's nothing to do with bread, it's to do with people's housing. And without these government subsidies for housing, the entire economy would collapse.
It's not the 18th century, it's the 19th century, it's the Speenham land system.
It's 1601.
Well, no, that you're thinking...
The poor law
made people pay rates so that they would actually have some resources to look after poor people in their communities. But the Speenham land system, which came in the sort of 1790s, subsidised farmers to pay wages so that they didn't have to pay proper wages. And we've got definitely got a Speenham land system in Britain now. That was abolished by the poor law reforms of 1830 when they built workhouses. So, I mean, this is a perennial issue. I'll just make a couple of points on the unemployment figures. Productivity in Britain per worker is definitely going down because we've got more people employed, as Tim points out, although the population has grown as well. People think about immigration and so on. But the economy is still smaller than it was before 2008. Now, that means that these jobs must be low wage, low productivity jobs. And of course, that's not how they run it in socialist republics like Norway.
Okay, let's go now to Prime Minister's questions anyway. And they were talking about the related topic. Ed and Dave discussed poverty and particularly Ed Miliband, the leader of the opposition. He was discussing the report from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation that came out just after Christmas about the number of people in Britain who are now living in poverty.
In Britain today, there are 13 million people living in poverty. That is a shocking figure. And what is scandalous is that for the first time ever, the majority of those people are living not in jobless families, but in working families. What's his explanation for that?
The explanation for this is what the Institute for Fiscal Studies have said. And they said this: wages have increased much less quickly than inflation. As I say, that is not surprising. We had the biggest recession we had in 100 years. It will be astonishing if household incomes haven't fallen and earnings haven't fallen. The fact is, we're recovering from the mess that they left us. Every week he comes here. And raises a new problem that he created. We had the betting problem, then we had the banking problem, then we had the deficit problem, and now we have the cost of living problem. He's like an arsonist who goes round setting fire after fire and then complains when the fire brigade aren't putting out the fires fast enough. Why doesn't he start with an apology for the mess that he left us?
He comes here every week and does his Bullingdon Club routine, and all he shows is that he has absolutely no understanding of the lives of people up and down this country. That is the reality. Ordinary families are working harder for longer for less. He's cutting taxes for millionaires and not helping them. The minimum wage is falling in value. He can't be the solution to the cost of living crisis because he just doesn't understand the problem.
We are cutting taxes for everyone in our country. And we're only able to do that because we've controlled spending. What he cannot face is the fact the economy is improving. For months they told us to listen to the IMF. Remember that? 5 tweets in 1 month from the Shadow Chancellor, listen to the IMF. Now the IMF are telling us the economy is growing, stick to the plan, unemployment's going down, not a word.
Now, mate started off well, Ed Miliband, with a very, very good point, which is over the number of people now in poverty, 13 million, Martin. But he doesn't really seem to be able to reply to Cameron's jibes and answers. And particularly, right at the very end there, the Prime Minister is really sticking the knife in, saying, well, your Chancellor said we've got to listen to the IMF, we must listen to the IMF. Now the IMF are telling, actually, the country's doing really well. We're forecasting 2.4% growth.
Well, I think anybody who listens to the IMF needs their head examined, whatever they're saying, quite frankly. From my point of view, the economic debate at the moment is there's two levels to it. So the first level is let's presume that the economy is improving and that unemployment is going down. There are questions about the statistics, there's questions about whether it will actually happen, but let's just say that it does. And the economy is gradually going to improve. And then, of course, we're now talking about what kind of society we want to see on the other side of this crisis. And I think that we're going to see differentiation between the parties as they say, well, now we've got a bit of slack, what are we going to do? I mean, the Prime Minister was quite clear there. He wants to cut taxes for everybody in the country. So he's quite clear about what, including the wealthy. Now, I would suggest isn't that
what they voted for?
Well, as long as they win the election, and they've got the mandate, but he's making it absolutely clear that that is a priority. I would suggest that the Liberal Democrats have already made clear that they wouldn't see cutting taxes for the wealthy as a priority in a situation like this, and nor would I. And the Labour Party front bench, we're all engaged in this debate now about what we're going to do with this recovery. I'm afraid I'm going to be like the 13th fairy in the Sleeping Beauty, because in actual fact, it's all based on quantitative easing. If you look what happened this time last year, when they tried to talk in the US about reducing quantitative easing, there was a panic immediately in the stock market. So they then switched all the money taps back on, and the stock markets in the US and Britain are booming, absolutely booming. This has got no basis in reality, and something, for example, a war with Syria, will cause the whole thing to fall down in a morning. And that, and whoever comes to power after the next election, they'd better have a plan B for when it all comes unstuck.
So, Tim, hasn't Martin got a point here that actually, because all of the growth seems to be being caused through asset prices and quantitative easing, printing money, that's one of the reasons why people aren't actually feeling the recovery on the ground. They're not feeling with having more cash in their pocket.
Well, there are more people working now, but I do accept, I think the average family's not feeling more cash in their pocket. And I think that is going to be the real test for whoever is in government next time around. I actually agree with nearly everything Martin says. Perhaps I'm an old school socialist as well. But I think
common sense is what I would say.
I think if you want sustained growth, I think if you want people to feel like they're part of society, if they go out and do a decent day's work, they should earn a decent day's pay. And I think that's about, I think the real test now is if we are seeing sustained growth, it's about now is the time to consider increasing the minimum wage to a wage level which is more sustainable. And I think it's also a chance for us to look again at where people pay tax and continue what the government have already done to take more people out of paying tax and increase people's tax allowances, so those who earn the least are not being asked to pay unproportionate amounts of tax. Let's remember, just a few hundred pounds in tax to someone on minimum wage makes a big difference.
What about this figure of 13 million in poverty? Because I don't know if you heard, but the whole of the House of Commons for a few seconds actually fell silent. 13 million people.
Well, I think there are a lot of people who are, their family incomes are probably below £20,000.
But what they've seen is a real squeeze. We're the seventh richest country in the world, Tim.
Well, this is one reason, I've got to say, why my party here in Bristol is actually agreeing that we should freeze the council tax. Although, ultimately, it's only a small amount of money over the 3 years, it can make a real difference if you're on minimum wage income and you're facing a £1,200, £1,400 council tax bill. Just knocking out £125 of extra bills over the next 3 years will help people. And that's why we're making that argument to other politicians that, you know, an offer is on the table from government of extra money. We have found some additional money which does not involve cutting anything at all from extra services. And so that's one thing we think we can do here in Bristol just to help people out. Because I agree, I think a lot of families are struggling with bills at the moment. They haven't yet seen the benefit of the recovery. Hopefully they will do over the next few years, but it's something we can do now to help people.
Can we afford a Bristol Arena, which is going to cost altogether £91 million?
Well, the arena, of course, has got a bit of a complicated funding model, and it is to be funded through business rates, through income that we receive through development.
But wouldn't that otherwise be come to council to go into services?
No, we wouldn't be able to use that money directly for services, and it's a new arrangement we've had with government. We didn't have this before. We can retain all the business rates in certain enterprise areas around the city. The arena will be core of that, and the concept behind the arena is the arena will instigate the growth, which will then pay for the arena. So, I mean, I've got to say, at the heart of the arena project is a bit of a gamble. We think it's worth taking because we do think it will actually help generate a lot of economic growth within the city, and that will help generate the jobs, generate the income, and so the arena will pay for itself. I do understand, of course, the confusion amongst people when they see £90 million worth of cuts being talked about and £90 million being spent on the arena. It is a different type of money. That seems a strange thing to say. But what we can't do is use that arena money to subsidise the budget. That's not lawful.
So we're not allowed to say, no, we don't want an arena, we just want to carry on with the council and have no cuts. We can't do that.
You can certainly say, no, I don't want an arena. That will have a very little effect on the council budget. In reality, that probably would affect only about £1 million worth of the cuts.
I mean, do you have sympathy with the group, the reasonably new group that's been set up called Save Our City? They're saying no to the £90 million worth of cuts. In fact, they're set to demonstrate Saturday week, the 8th of February at 1 o'clock in Castle Park against these cuts, which are coming in, I think, around about the rate of between £25 and £30 million a year for the next 3 years.
I do have sympathy, and actually they joined us in protesting to help save Hengrove Play Park, which we've already won that battle with the mayor. And one thing I have put to the mayor over the last few months is that he inflated the need for savings. He didn't need to propose the amount of cuts he has done. I continue to argue that, and I do believe built within his budget is a lot of flexibility. There's a lot of hidden growth that he hasn't accounted for. Ultimately, though, now we are trying to set a budget. We do need to set a budget, and those could be battles we can have on future years. I've got to say, where it says services might be cut in year three, we can come back and readdress that once we have shown that that growth money is there. The issue we're now putting to the mayor is that you can afford to freeze council tax, and we are going back to him on several of the services he's currently proposing to cut to say we think you can think again. The majority of his reductions are around back office issues. That's still people and it's still their jobs. I mean, I think the mayor on radio said a few weeks ago he was really proud of his budget. I wouldn't be proud about people losing their jobs, but I think also people would accept that if the council can save money, especially on its back offices, it should try to do that. It's public money and we should try to find more efficient ways to spend it.
And what about the fact that we're generating through these low pay and people on benefits who simply can't get a job, whatever it is, 3.5 million across the country unemployed? These people won't be able to go to the arena, will they? They won't be able to afford it.
No, they won't. But what the arena will do is it will generate additional jobs. It will generate additional jobs in the hotel industry, in the entertainment industries around it, in restaurants. And those will generate jobs for those people. That's the concept. The arena is a spark which generates a lot of additional income. I mean, the arena won't just be visited by Bristolians. It'll be visited by people from across the region. And that will draw in their money to spend in our city. And that is the economic plan behind the arena. They will generate far more in income for the city. Eventually that rolls down to you then getting a job in the new hotel, which is built to service the additional demand created by the arena.
And to what extent are the council able to say, well, we want jobs at the arena to go to local people, and we want the permanent jobs, that is the construction jobs, and we also want the permanent jobs which are there to go to local people?
I've got to say that is always a problem for councils, because there are certain rules and restrictions on how we can restrict jobs. What we can do is we can restrict providing, in particular, training opportunities for people who are not in employment, and we can put that in as part of the build agreements. I do hope the mayor will do that, so we can also generate apprenticeships. I mean, the council last year, I think, generated something somewhere in the region of 200 to 300 apprenticeships, and I think those are key things, giving people opportunities to get skills, to get into work, and that's something the council can do and can work with contractors to do.
Martin, KPMG being investigated this week over Co-op Bank audits. I mean, I must say, the whole business with the Co-op Bank makes me, it looks to me as if some of the big banks have just sunk it with a torpedo. It was the People's Bank, it isn't anymore. About 8 to 10 years ago, they discovered a spy on the board who was recording Co-op Bank board meetings. Now, KPMG are being investigated over the audits that they did. Its role as auditor is being investigated to the troubled Cooperative Bank, which almost collapsed last year and could face a massive fine. Financial Reporting Council today launched an investigation into the preparation, approval and audit of the Co-op Bank's accounts up to 2012. KPMG audited the Co-op Group and the bank for more than 30 years and also advised it on deals including the disastrous takeover of Britannia Building Society. Last year it collected £7.4 million in fees from the Co-op, including £3.3 million for advising on its, again, disastrous attempt to purchase the Project Verde bank branches from Lloyds Banking Group. Now, KPMG, the Bristol City Council, has just bought their headquarters in Bristol. It seemed to be quite close to the mayor. We've also had this free advisor, volunteer, Matt Payne from KPMG, helping George to prepare the budgets. I mean, is this a sound and a safe company, Martin? I mean, we've had scandals before with KPMG. These are the auditors. Who audits the auditors?
Well, that is a question, isn't it? Who does order the auditors? I mean, the Co-op Bank, frankly, have got themselves into trouble by trying to behave like another, like a bank. And KPMG will be sending there, why don't you behave more like the other banks? They should have concentrated on their niche market. They knew what they were doing. They should have stuck with that instead of trying to be ambitious. And of course, that's what's.
But it looks like it may not have just been the Co-op's fault here. If KPMG have been messing around with their accounts and tripping them up, actually.
Well, indeed, and KPMG are clearly need to be put under the spotlight. And another spotlight needs to be put on Goldman Sachs, that other wonderful organisation, because of course they were the people that advised that the sale of the Royal Mail at the price it was sold, which turns out to have lost the taxpayer up to $3 billion. And because, of course, Vince Cable said, don't worry about this. In 3 months, we'll have a look at it and you'll see that it's all settled down. It looks pretty clear now that they were telling their investors to buy the shares. And, in fact, they bought a lot themselves and lots of insiders bought the shares. And they knew, in fact, that the shares were wrongly priced. They advised that they were wrongly priced. In local government, that would lead to prosecutions, probably. But in national government, it's just been forgotten already.
Tim, this is a little bit like deja vu, because back in 2008, it was revealed that KPMG had approved HBOS's accounts. This is the bank which were one of the ones that caused such a gigantic financial disaster when Lloyds purchased it, and it turned out that it actually wasn't worth anything like the books said it was. This, they put aside £370 million, KPMG, of provisions to pay for losses. And we've also had another scandal in the United States with KPMG, one of their senior partners being caught exchanging confidential client information for Rolex watches and big bundles of cash. I mean, are these the right sort of people to be trusted as auditors and wandering around the City Council or helping Mayor Ferguson with his budget?
I think there's a real issue where auditors are playing the role of gamekeeper and poacher at the same time, and I think that's what's coming out, and I think that's what the real concern, and I do think that really does need to be looked at. Just to be clear, Grant Thornton are the council's auditors, not KPMG.
And
we didn't actually buy the building from KPMG. They're actually a tenant now of the council. They actually rent within that building. They didn't own it. But it is for the mayor to decide his advisors. We can ask questions of those advisors, but those are the mayor's appointments. That's, I'm afraid, the rule. That's the way the new system works.
All right, retired police chief has been arrested on suspicion of sexual and physical abuse in the North Wales care home scandal. Maybe not a lot we can say about this because the guy's just been arrested, but it's been very little reported, only actually in the Daily Mirror, I think, this week. Gordon Anglesey is the 18th arrested by police from Operation Paleol, investigating claims of sexual abuse at 18 care homes in the region between 1963 and 1992. Retired police chief has been arrested on suspicion of sexual and physical abuse of care home boys aged as young as 8. Former North Wales Superintendent Gordon Anglesey, 76, was questioned over allegations that 7 children were assaulted between 1975 and 1983. I think the main point to make here, Tim, is to what extent is the care system actually caring for our children?
Well, I think the care system now is a very good system, but I think we need to reflect that the system before, which was a very institution-based system with secrecy and silence around it, bred an atmosphere which allowed abusers to get access to children. I'm not saying that this man is guilty or not, I don't know, but I mean, we're also aware in Northern Ireland they've got open hearings now into the abuse there within their care system. There have been other allegations of historic problems. I think we need to make sure we uncover what's happened, but we need to make sure this is not repeated in the future. I think this is part of a problem of a society in the past where, to be honest, child abuse was always there, but it was covered up. It's good that we can talk about this now. It is good that we can prosecute on this now, but what we must do is make sure we also learn from this and it's not repeated.
Of course, the worry is that he, as the police superintendent, was one of the people who would have been in charge of an investigation, and yet he, it seems, may have been involved in the abuse right from the start. Now, I mean, we've heard all sorts of scandals. I mean, there's the Jimmy Savile scandal, much of that which was reported to police and nothing happened. And also, of course, things like the Hillsborough. Do you think we can now have confidence in our police? What has changed?
I mean, the police are like any organisation. They're made up of humans, and that means they are capable of error. I think the key thing we've got to ensure is that the police
are
held to account.
They're capable of crime, too.
They're capable of crime, they're capable of error, they're capable of conspiracy. I think the vast majority of police officers are good people trying to do a difficult job. But when you have power, you have temptation. And I think what we have seen in the past, where we trusted the police, some have abused that power and have used that to cover up mistakes they may have made or have used that for crime. And I think what we need to make sure we have got are robust systems in place. If people do complain, they can be investigated. And I think there are questions about the current systems that are in place. Are they robust enough? I mean, the independent investigators that are currently used often are made up of former police officers. And I think that does raise reasonable questions and doubt within the public's mind. I mean, to add to this, we also even have the Plebgate affair, which has also sort of exposed allegations of police making statements which were not true. I mean, that's still being investigated.
Yeah. Martin, Mr. Anglesey is a Rotary Club member and a Freemason. He was quizzed in December as part of the probe.
Well, as I can't comment on an individual case. I've no idea whether this guy's guilty or not. But you mentioned Northern Ireland earlier, and when Ken Livingstone was first elected as an MP, he made his maiden speech in the House of Commons about the Kinkora Boys' Home in Northern Ireland, which had been used by MI5 as a honey trap for loyalist paramilitary leaders. So they were getting loyalist paramilitaries in there, having sex with the boys and blackmailing them. And that, I'm afraid, has also gone on in the past, may still be going on now. We have got ourselves, the question of who will guard the guardians, who will audit the auditors. These questions are eternal.
OK, back to the Commons now. And Stephen Timms put a question to the Prime Minister about food banks.
Stephen Timms.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to associate myself with the condolences the Prime Minister expressed on behalf of the whole House. The Trussell Trust coordinates the fast-growing network, now numbering some 400, of church-based food banks, which between them provided food for 500,000 people just between April and December last year. Would the Prime Minister be willing to meet with representatives of the Trussell Trust to discuss with them the very big challenges challenges that they're grappling with.
I'd be very happy to meet with them. We've listened carefully to the Trussell Trust. One of the things that they wanted to see done by this government, and indeed by the previous government, was to allow food banks to be promoted in job centres. We've allowed that to happen. That has increased the use of food banks, but I think it's important to do the right thing than something that might just seem politically convenient.
Tim Kent, you're the leader of the Lib Dems here on Bristol City Council. What are your thoughts about this? Because we are, like I said earlier, on the seventh richest country in the world. The figures quoted there, 500,000 people using food banks between April and December last year.
I mean, it seems shocking, doesn't it, that, a Western country as rich as us, that so many of our population are forced to use food banks. I think what we've seen is a growth in the use of food banks, because when people have lost employment, what they don't have, which maybe they've had 20 years ago, is savings. A lot of families are living sort of hand-to-hand, and so that month's income immediately goes out on bills. There's no safety net often within families, and so they're often finding a crisis of income straight away. I think also we do need to reflect on some of the welfare changes. Many of this we understand is necessary, but in particular one which I've got to say here in Bristol we've completely rejected and completely opposed has been that of the under occupancy charge, or far more commonly known as the bedroom tax. This is bad law, it's been badly implemented, and in Bristol we're strongly opposing this. And as you're probably aware, yesterday a Liberal Democrat and Labour councillor called in the Mayor's decision on his revoking the no eviction policy, because we believe here in Bristol actually we should stand up to that law and even help our tenants challenge that law.
Martin, what are your thoughts about the just general situation with poverty? We heard also from Ed Miliband saying we're now in the situation where of the 13 million people living officially in poverty in Britain, most of them have someone working in the home.
Well, I think it comes back to the macroeconomics we were talking about in the first part of the show.
OK, well, let's not revisit
that.
Martin, let me ask you something more specifically.
I'm come back specifically. The welfare reforms, I'm glad Tim has picked up on that. Many of these welfare reforms, in fact, not just the bedroom tax, virtually all of it, are badly thought out. The universal credit, for example, has led directly to a situation where buy-to-let landlords, who are being subsidised by Help to Buy, are basically saying they won't take housing benefit tenants. And that means that, and not just that they're not going to take new tenants, they're going to evict existing tenants. And I've had this problem very recently myself. I was evicted from my property, which is a private rented property, and I had great difficulty in securing anywhere else to live. A friend of mine has also been evicted. You know, I know people who are already suffering, and this is not to do with the macroeconomics. This is simply to do with bad policy, but based upon. Basically upon political criteria that we want to see the poor punished. There's a section of our society that's actually really keen for that, and there's some electoral mileage in it, and that's why we're doing it.
What I was going to say actually was rather than talk about explaining the macroeconomics, as what would be, I mean, if you were the Chancellor George Osborne today, you had a chance to implement your plan B tonight, what would it be?
Well, universal credit is basically a good idea, and in Switzerland they're having a referendum on it, and in Cyprus they're going to introduce it, but it's a universal credit, you simply give it to people. You don't say you've got to do this and do that to get it. In other words, you give everybody a guaranteed income. Now, in the past, Liberal Democrats used to talk about these radical ideas. The Greens have still got it in their manifesto. I think as the crisis develops, because the crisis isn't over in my view, not by a long shot, we are going to have to talk about these more radical ideas.
On the bedroom tax, it's quite interesting to see that there's someone who they're calling a local hero from Romford, who did a little bit of research on the legal aspects of the bedroom tax, has found a loophole in it, which looks to see 40,000 people who've had to pay the bedroom tax actually getting their money back, Tim. 40,000 people across the country, and this is a chap called Peter Baker, who's a independent tax consultant, has discovered a loophole in the law. They shouldn't be charging this in the first place.
It's not the only loophole, but it does appear that those people who have been in receipt of housing benefits since 1996 consistently are exempt from the bedroom tax. So it is the irony that neighbours, one who may have only been in receipt of housing benefit for a few years and another who's been in receipt for 20 years would actually find one would be charged and one wouldn't. And this is why we come back to the fact this is bad legislation. There have been other challenges as well. And this is why we actually specifically asked the Mayor in December to work with tenants to help them challenge the law within the tribunals that are available to tenants to do that. And it's a real shame that the Mayor's not taken that up. And, I mean, it is going to come back back now to a scrutiny committee to look at. And I think we will be able to question the mayor why he has not taken up that call
Good
to
question.
Assist tenants.
Good question. Maybe he's listening too much still to his banker, merchant venturer friends. Anyway, let's go back to Westminster for a final time in this hour and hear from Robert Halford, who is asking about a problem for many, many of us now. That's utility bills.
Mr. Robert Halfon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. 45% of people don't pay their utility bills by direct debit. 1 million of them don't have bank accounts. Yet energy companies are charging, on average, £115 extra for people who don't pay by direct debit, hitting pensioners and the poorest the most. Will my honourable friend look into this, given that the government is doing everything possible by cutting energy bills by £50?
I'm certainly happy to look into this issue, because that is why we've taken the steps to compel the energy companies to put people onto the lowest tariffs, and we want to make sure that everyone can take advantage of that. As he said, we've also cut energy bills by £50 by rolling back the costs of some of the green measures, and we should continue to make this market more competitive to give more choice to consumers and to encourage the switching, which happened a huge amount towards the end of last year, that has saved many people many hundreds of pounds.
Martin, this is costing people by just simply not being on direct debit. Many of the people just can't be because they don't have bank accounts. This is costing £115 extra for the poorest in our society.
Yes, and the government's saying, yes, we're going to intervene, we're going to increase competition and so on. But the problem isn't more competition. These industries used to be owned by the people, and the government could simply instruct them to give people the lowest tariff.
Well, they can't now, can they?
No, they can't. And the fact in many well-managed northern European countries, the government still controls these industries and they can just tell them what to do.
Tim, it's easier for the energy companies to get money off people through direct debit. They just press a button, the computer does it for them. Therefore, they're bound to say, we're not going to charge as much if you do this, aren't they?
I think it's not the small saving that perhaps you get by going to direct debit, which might be a £2 discount a month. I think the real issue here is, and it's been going on for decades now, and it is not right. Those people are on pay meters, so they have to put a pay key in, are charged far more for their energy than others. And that is a tax on the poor. It happened, I've got to say, I'm afraid it happened even when it was a state-owned affair. They had to pay more. They're still having to pay more. That is wrong. I don't think we should be getting to the issue of whether or not people get a small discount by switching to direct debit. We should break down those figures. Why is it so high? And I think what you will do is you will find those people who have to do prepaid keys are being charged far more for their energy, and that is not right.
Finally, NHS patient data is to be made available for sale to drug and insurance firms. We hear in The Guardian this week, drug and insurance companies will from later this year to be able to buy information on patients, including mental health conditions and diseases such as cancer, as well as smoking and drinking habits, once a single English database of medical data has been created. Harvesting from GP and hospital records, medical data covering the entire population will be uploaded to the repository, controlled by a new arm's length NHS information centre starting this March. You have to opt out if you don't want your medical records to go, Tim.
Well, I think a lot of people will be worried about this because it's got the Big Brother stamped all over it. And what we've often found is that it is not always that these organisations intend to use your data in a wrong way. It's the unintended consequences. It's when it leaks out. It's when a laptop is left lying around. And it's how it could be used in the future is what we would question. And I do note they're not including names, but they are including people's NHS number. And I think if they do want to do this, what they should do is anonymise this. If the drug companies are saying this data will help us in advancements in medicine, fine, but I actually think what they should do is give that data anonymously to the drug companies.
Well, the Guardian has recommended an opt-out form. Get it into your doctor quickly if you're worried about this kind of thing. And I'll put that on our show page, which is www.thisweek.org.uk later on this evening. Martin, very quickly.
Well, the insurance issue is the major one. I mean, if people... this is what's the problem in the US. They don't want to... The insurance companies aren't interested in people who are going to get ill.
OK, that's all. Thanks very much. It's time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks for this week's guest, Lib Dem leader on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. After the news, NHS.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, two Twitter trolls have been jailed for sending threatening messages on the social media site. Isabella Sawley and John Nimmo targeted campaigner Caroline Criado Perez, who last summer called for more women to appear on banknotes. They've been sentenced to 20 weeks between them. Our reporter Ashish Joshi at Westminster Magistrates says their posts were horrible.
Here's one sent from Isabella Sawley to Caroline Criado Perez. It said, "Go kill yourself." John Nimmo sent a tweet saying, "I will find you," with a smiley face.